Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I'm honored to be joined by two terrific historians. Judkin Browning is professor and director of graduate studies in the Department of History at Appalachian State University, and has written two military histories of the Civil War, Shifting Loyalties and the 7 Days Battle. Timothy Silver is also a professor of history at Appalachian State University and also the author of two books, Mount Mitchell in the Black Mountains and A New Face on the Countryside, a foundational work in the field of environmental history. Now they have joined forces on a new book called An Environmental History of the Civil War. It came out back in April from the University of North Carolina Press. Dr. Browning, Dr. Silver, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Now, historians don't often co-author books. And so, Judkin, I wonder if you could tell us the story of how you two came to collaborate on this project and how you structured your work together.
Sure. Well, to defer a little bit to Tim as the elder of our partnership, it was really his idea. And Tim had been kicking around an idea of an environmental history of the Civil War for I'm not sure how long, a number of years. And somewhere along the way, he realized that the Civil War literature was pretty vast, and he would have a hard time wrapping his brain around it. And perhaps he was thinking of, maybe I need to share this duty with somebody. And then he and I took a fortuitous trip to Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2011, when we were both working on some elements of the 7 Days Battle campaign. And we just talked about that campaign the whole ride up and back. And I'd like to think that maybe planted a bit of a seed in Tim's head that maybe I was the guy to work with on this. And it was about a year later, in 2012, when he came to me and asked, would I like to co-author this with him? And I agreed to do it. And we actually went to a local establishment here in Boone called the Boone Saloon. And we sat down, and at lunch, the first thing we did for the book, the first writing, if you will, was penciling out some thematic ideas on a cocktail napkin at the table. And that's really sort of where the project started. And then when we started writing the book together, it wasn't a case of I would write chapter one and he would write chapter two, as I think many collaborations are. It was actually a case of typically we would meet and outline the chapter. We would reserve a study carrel in the library, and we'd outline a chapter. And then I'd lay down the sort of base foundation of the chapter because I was pretty familiar with the chronology of the Civil War. And then I would give it to Tim, and he would add some environmental layers, and he would give it back, and then I would give it back, and we would do this quite a lot. And we ended up doing that for every single chapter. And I'd like to think that there's not a paragraph in the book, and probably very few sentences, that don't have both of our fingerprints on them.
Wow. Now, let's get into it. And the book it's so dense. It's not at all dense at the level of prose. It's really crisply written. It comes in under 200 pages, quite impressively. But topically, you know, each paragraph in many cases could be an article or even a book itself. You cover so much ground. And so in this conversation, we'll only scratch the surface for sure. But let's begin where you begin the book, exploring illness and disease. And you write that by the end of its first year, the war had already created a new and distinct pattern of microbial exchange. Tim, I wonder if you could tell us what that looked like and what the effects were of that.
Sure. What the Civil War does, maybe more than anything, is put people in motion. And anytime you do that, you're going to have a disruption to the microbial world. And to simply state it, what happened as a result of the Civil War is that some highly contagious sort of crowd diseases like smallpox and measles became more established in the South, while some environmental diseases, notably malaria, moved into areas of the North. And this is because of soldiers moving back and forth between the areas, civilians on the move, that kind of thing. So it really shook up the microbial world.
Yeah, and then in the second chapter, you turn your attention to weather. And weather is sort of a tricky thing to figure out how to, you know, put thinking about causality with the war. In the book, you argue that the success of operations often hinged on chancy atmospheric conditions that fluctuate wildly and without warning. But you also warn that counterfactual speculations about the weather's impact are, in your words, as dangerous as it is appealing. And so we should resist the urge to claim, you know, for instance, that McClellan's forces would have taken Richmond had it only rained a bit less. So, Judkin, how do you think we should account for the role of weather in the war?
Well, I mean, that's right. One of the things that we wanted to be sort of very aware of is something that Civil War historians really don't like is this concept of environmental determinism, which is that, you know, the environment decided the outcome and it really didn't matter which human was in command. And that's what we're arguing against in some ways. What happens is that humans make decisions, of course, based on the environmental realities. Sometimes humans make good decisions in response to the environment, you know, in response to rain or mud or something like that. And sometimes humans become paralyzed by it and make bad decisions. And so that's what our whole "it's as dangerous as it is appealing" comment was about. Because what we try to point out is that while McClellan becomes cautious during the 7 days campaign because the rain slows him down and he wants to rely very, very heavily on his heavy artillery, which, of course, is hard to move in the mud, the Confederate commanders, not just Robert E. Lee, but even earlier ones like John Magruder near Yorktown, the Confederate commanders make decisions that utilize the environment as well. And it just turns out that the Confederates made better decisions than the Union generals in this particular campaign. And so we do stress that we should resist the urge to blame any outcome on the rain, the heat, the cold, the whatever, that humans are making decisions in this environment. I also want to point out something that the reader would pick up on or the reader might notice, and something I didn't address in question one, is we decided with each of our themes to cover one particular season or one particular section of the war, and hence why we covered disease in 1861, because so many armies coming together. But we chose 1862 as the seasons of war, the spring and summer of 1862, to discuss weather, because it was such a major, the atmospheric conditions in 1862 were so profound that they did influence multiple campaigns, certainly the Richmond campaign, but the flooding that occurs throughout much of the South around the Mississippi River, the Yazoo River, the Tennessee River, the Ouachita River. I mean, it really damages Southern food production, which is going to have long-term consequences for the South. Certainly influences certain military campaigns. Fort Henry, for instance, in western Tennessee is basically submerged by the Tennessee River and so therefore can't offer any substantial defense. And then, of course, the rain that occurs around Richmond that really stymies McClellan and gives the Confederates an opportunity for Robert E. Lee to eventually launch an attack on McClellan that causes him to retreat. But the weather was important across the country, and something that I think a lot of Civil War historians aren't terribly familiar with is that some of the worst weather, some of the worst rain in U.S. history is occurring in California in 1862. They have a seriously catastrophic flood that turns the Central Valley of California into a 6,000 square mile inland sea. And between the flooding and a later drought, wipes out about 500,000 cattle in California. I mean, it's a really devastating event, and one that neither Tim or I were really aware of until we started researching this book. And so it's one of those wonderful opportunities of serendipity when you're researching something and you end up learning something entirely new that you were completely unaware of. And so the role of weather is one that is important, but it's also one that humans make decisions based on, based on events, and that the environment itself does not dictate the outcome, but how humans react to that environment is what leads to the outcome.
Yeah. And your mention of California really reminded me of something that's kind of historiographically pretty cool about this book, is that it really is, in Megan Kate Nelson's title of her recent book, it's really a three-cornered war in the way that you tell it, especially in the early chapters here. Was that your intention going in, or was it these stories that you uncovered that made you realize you needed to look more broadly beyond the Mississippi?
Well, I think
we have geographic scope. Go ahead, Tim.
No, I was going to say that we wanted at least the kind of book that I always envisioned was a sort of a sweeping kind of history that would cover a lot of ground and, also kind of embody the theme of environmental history, which is that it's impossible to understand people and their actions apart from the natural environment. And of course, that shifts depending on which kind of natural environment you're talking about. The deserts of New Mexico are different from the forests of Tennessee. And so that was kind of in the cards from the first, but Judkin's quite right. The flood and the implications of that for the Confederacy's effort to move into the West, was pretty new to us. And of course we found out Megan was working on it and we're able to, stand on her shoulders a little bit. So. Yeah. But it was always in the design to make this a quick, good read about the Civil War and the environment.
Oh, you absolutely succeeded. So let's get back into it and look at chapter 3, which is about food. And you argued that food was a weapon of war in your phrase. And you showed this is true both at the level of the military and also domestic policy. So it's both what commanders are deciding to do, but also what's going on in the cabinets in DC and Richmond. Could you take us through an episode or two where we can really see food as a weapon of war? Let's go to Tim with that one.
Well, of course, the sort of classic example of food as a weapon is the Siege of Vicksburg, which Judkin's really probably a little bit better equipped to talk about than I am. But one of the other things we wanted to get to was the impact of these large armies when they moved into areas. And the classic example of that is at Antietam. I mean, Sharpsburg, Maryland, where the Battle of Antietam was fought, was a small village, really of about 1,300 people before the battle. By the time both armies get there, it has a population of over 50,000. Which I believe is roughly the population of Chicago at the time, which was, I think, the ninth largest city in the country and maybe the fastest growing. So one of the things we wanted to do in the food chapter was sort of look at what happens when you get these instant cities. And Antietam's a really good example that the civilian population left. And when they came back, there's absolutely no food to be had because the armies have taken it. And then eventually when the armies moved on, it took the civilian population a really long time to recover from that, to get back to anything resembling normal. And so it wasn't just a matter of sort of food being used as a weapon, but food became a problem for everybody who was anywhere near one of these major battles. And, we think that's one of the ways that the book really contributes some to the existing historiography, the Siege of Vicksburg and, things like that are pretty well known, but the aftermath of these battles, particularly the effect on local civilian populations, are something that hasn't been looked at a lot.
Thanks. And then the next chapter turns to animals, and you sketch out pretty distinct northern and southern livestock cultures that really had a material effect on both sides' war efforts. What are some of those differences that we see?
Well, I mean, the basic sort of most simplistic difference when you're talking about edible livestock like cattle or hogs are that southern farmers practiced a free range form of agriculture in which they would just, you know, let their livestock roam the surrounding fields and woods and essentially feed themselves, which was probably a higher quality of life for the livestock. But as somebody put it, it didn't lead to a tender cut of beef. Whereas in the north, the livestock tended to be penned into pastures and so were grazed deliberately in that way. And so the biggest difference was that livestock, both cattle and hogs in the north, tended to be larger and have more meat at the time of slaughter. And so Southerners had become used to roaming livestock. There weren't any fence laws really in the South. And you had to sort of fence and protect your crops as opposed to penning in your livestock. And it led to just a smaller sort of pound per ratio of meat for each animal. And so when the Civil War comes along, the fact that the North has more livestock and the fact that the North has heavier livestock means that they have more food that they can provide. And of course, they have better processing centers established and set up in Chicago and particularly in Cincinnati, which earns the nickname Porkopolis because of the number of pigs that it processes in the years before the war. And so going into the war, the Union Army was going to benefit much more from food production or the amount of food provided than Southern soldiers were going to. And another thing that people aren't perhaps intimately aware of is that many Southern farmers imported livestock. We think of Southerners eating pork and cornbread at every meal. Frederick Law Olmsted, when he toured the South, claimed that he had cornbread at every dining table from the coast to the mountains to the Mississippi River. And there's some truth in that. But what people don't realize is that with the attention to growing cash crops, particularly cotton and tobacco, then a lot of Southern farmers found it more economical to just import beef from northern states or import pork from northern states rather than waste the resources on growing their own. So when the war begins, of course, that trade stops. And so Southerners are immediately at a bit of a food disadvantage that a large supply of their meat has been cut off. So they can revert back to the supply of meat they already have. But as we just mentioned, it's providing 25% less meat per animal than is happening in the North. And so the South finds itself in a real in a real difficult situation fairly early in the war. And it continues throughout the war, of course. And the second thing I want to mention, sort of animal theme, is horses and mules. And I think one of the things that was really revealing to both Tim and myself while researching this was the state of livestock in terms of horses and mules in the United States. Horses, of course, in an army are the engines. I mean, they are the modern day equivalent of mechanized warfare. You don't go anywhere or move anything without a horse. I mean, there are railroads, of course, and there are riverboats, but military campaigns don't always align along railroad tracks or rivers. And so horses pulled the wagons, horses carried the cavalry, horses carried the officers, horses did everything. And there were only about 7 million horses and mules in the United States in 1861 when the war broke out. And it was too late by the time the war broke out to create a breeding farm to raise military horses, because horses take about a 10-month gestation period to be born, and then it usually takes horses about 4 years to develop the necessary strength and maturity to be used for military service. So what that means is if both sides decided to establish a horse breeding farm for military animals the day the war began, then those first horses would be ready the year after the war ended. So they basically had to make do with the number of horses and mules that were in the United States at the time. Well, of course, there were more in the North, and so they were going to have access to more horses, and the North figures out fairly effective procurement methods to purchase horses, sometimes in bulk and sometimes just from individual farmers. And the Union quartermaster system during the course of the war becomes quite effective at acquiring horses and replacing lost horses in the Union Army, whereas, of course, the Confederacy is really going to struggle with this. And the bigger difference for the Confederacy is if you were a Union cavalry soldier, you just reported and the Union, the federal government provided you with a horse. If you were a Confederate cavalry soldier, you were expected to bring your own horse. And the Confederacy doesn't have the procurement systems to provide horses. And so that's going to lead to, it's going to lead to some abuse during the course of the, during the course of the war. If a cavalry soldier wants to go home for a little while and just sell his horse, and then he can get a furlough to go home and find a new horse. And so the South is facing some real difficult issues in terms of procuring animals, and certainly different difficult issues in terms of the amount of livestock to feed the army. And the final point I would make about the animals is we think of illnesses devastating humans, and of course they did. But what tends to get either not discussed at all or sort of brushed under the rug in a sentence or two is that epidemic diseases just devastated the animal population as well during the war. There were a variety of cattle fevers, particularly spread by ticks, that damaged the cattle population. There was an incredibly devastating hog cholera epidemic that wiped out untold hundreds of thousands of hogs in both armies during the war. And then, again, for that engine motive purpose for the army, horse diseases, particularly farcy and glanders, which was the most devastating. Highly contagious diseases that just annihilated large portions of the horse population in both the northern and southern armies. And there's really no cure for glanders. If your horse comes down with it, the most humane thing you can do is kill it and try to keep the disease spreading to healthy horses. And so the Civil War was a really difficult time to be an animal.
And there's that fascinating moment there in the glanders. And again, you have to move through all this very quickly, but it's where after Bull Run, I believe both sides have a glanders outbreak among their horses, and each side blames the other for it. And there's this suspicion of what we would now call, you know, biological warfare, especially. And there's some of that in the first chapter on human diseases also, where there's this, you know, around Fort Pillow or things where there's this sense that maybe there's, you know, that the other side is trying to sneak these germs and viruses into our lines. Is there any evidence for any intentional spread of disease as a weapon of war?
Well, the classic sort of example of that is something we cover in the first chapter, where there was an effort to spread disease into Washington, D.C., and particularly trying to use mosquito-borne diseases like yellow fever to infect the North. And there was this Dr. Blackburn from Kentucky, who was actually, some thought, involved in the plot to assassinate Lincoln, who sent a bunch of what he thought were infected blankets to Washington, D.C., and clothing also, which he hoped people would get in Washington and then somehow start an outbreak of yellow fever. He, of course, was on the Confederate side. And, you know, that didn't work. Obviously, nobody knew what caused yellow fever. You need the mosquito vector to cause it. But there's definitely an effort at that. And the suspicions about the animals, I think, is also telling. And then the stuff at Fort Pillow with smallpox, where a couple of prisoners from the North seem to have been sent down with smallpox. And, you know, people whether it's happening or not, there's this sort of thing lurking in the background in the minds of both sides that, well, maybe they're going to unleash some sort of of biological weapon on us. So it's definitely a part of the whole scenario. We didn't find, a lot of evidence that it was successful, for either side, but it was definitely in the mix.
That and chapter. Interject one other thing. Southerners believed that a lot of these illnesses that were associated with Southern was going to be a great advantage to them. And we mentioned in the book a lot of Southerners who think, oh, well, malaria and yellow fever will kill off the Northern soldiers. So, let them come on down. Well, they won't be able to handle it. And of course, that turned out not to be as potent an ally for the South as they thought it would.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hmm. And chapter 5 might be the most unexpected for a general reader coming to what they imagining what an environmental history of the war is going to look like, because you examine in that chapter death and disability. And you're in part building on Drew Faust's, path-breaking book, This Republic of Suffering, on the topic. But you add to that, in your words, the war forced both combatants and civilians to confront death as an ecological event. So what did that look like? And it looked pretty gross. So, Tim, could you tell us that?
Sure. And I'll admit, up front to having, over the course of working on this book, developed a kind of macabre fascination with this topic, drawing not only on Drew Faust's work, but also Ellen Stroud's work in environmental history. And so I started asking myself, well, what happens when, a person dies? And I found myself reading all this, literature from places like the Body Farm over at the University of Tennessee. And it's actually a pretty interesting process, I found. Almost a second somebody stops breathing, or a soldier died on the battlefield and stopped breathing, enzymes almost immediately begin to consume the dead cells, and it initiates decomposition, and bacteria feed on these cells, especially in the gastrointestinal tract. And one of the more bizarre facets of this is that the pancreas actually kind of digests itself. And within about 2 days, bodies begin to bloat, and they release hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, methane, just a host of noxious gases. So the chemistry of this is really pretty interesting. And what fascinated me was, of course, all these things combined to create the smell, the scent of death, putrefaction. And what really fascinated me, though, was that this is not just a human event, but all sorts of other organisms move in to live on human remains. The most common of these being blowflies, maggots, that kind of thing. But there's a wide variety of wasps and other things that enter into it. And so it's kind of at that moment of death that we really see human beings as part of the natural world. And the interesting thing about dead bodies, too, that we found out is that, dead bodies can contaminate the environment, but they don't in and of themselves really spread disease. But 19th century people did not know that, of course. And most of them subscribed to some sort of miasmatic theory of disease, that it was bad air and breathing bad air that caused diseases. So when a body started to stink, the important thing was to get that body away from people as quickly as possible. And there were some really ingenious ways of doing that that came out of the war. Inventions like body bags, sophisticated caskets, other means that would, help sort of ameliorate the smell until bodies could be disposed of. And it just really kind of struck me for the first time that this is people dealing with this as a kind of environmental, ecological sort of event. It's not just a cultural event where someone dies and you mourn the loss of the person or have a religious service. You also have to confront the ecology of death. And as I say, I developed, a kind of a macabre fascination with how different people dealt with this. So it's really interesting. In fact, there's one guy, Thomas Holmes, who was an embalmer, and he actually would go get bodies off the battlefield and preserve them and then display them in shops and places like Georgetown, Washington, D.C., and then tell people to come by and say, hey, look at my work, I'm a great embalmer. And some set up shop out on the battlefield where they would also embalm bodies. And I was, taken by Ellen Stroud's comment in one of her articles that bodies in death become commodities. And that was certainly true in the Civil War. They were harvested off the battlefield, processed, and shipped to different locales, usually to the north, just like any sort of commodity. So I found that whole thing really fascinating and to be part of sort of basic ecology, basic environmental interaction between people and nature.
Yeah, and it's a great photo you include of one of those on the battlefield demos of embalming. The book ends, the final chapter, it covers terrain, which is sort of more typical territory for military history. We know terrain is important in how wars unfold. And you write that the physical landscape usually dictated the strategy and the pace of the fighting, which I imagine most readers would expect to be true. But then you emphasize that the physical landscape, as we take it, was really, quote, the product of long-term interaction between people and nature. And so, Judkin, as a military historian, what are some examples of this? And why is it important to keep that in mind when we think about the terrain?
Yeah, because as you say, military historians are very cognizant of terrain. And of course, every book on every military campaign talks about the high ground, where the rivers are, the valleys, and what sort of impediments there were that sort of dictated strategy. But what we really look at as well is that a lot of these battlefields or places where fighting took place were not just sort of pristine wilderness that humans had never set foot on. And then, boom, these armies show up and have to make the best of a bad situation. But actually, the physical landscape was really changed over centuries of human inhabitation. And for human habitation. And so let's just give a couple of examples. We'll talk about the Battle of the Wilderness, which is familiar to a lot of readers. And the key distinguishing feature of the Battle of the Wilderness is the dense shrubs and foliage that dominated that field. And so when the armies come into that space and General Grant is actually trying to march his army through it quickly so that he can get to the more open fields to the south in order to engage Robert E. Lee's army. And Lee deliberately attacks Grant in that dense wilderness to try to limit Grant's numbers advantage and particularly his artillery advantage. And well, the wilderness itself, the reason it was the way it was because of what humans had done in that stretch of Virginia since at least the 1700s. It had originally been cleared and farmed for tobacco and other crops, and then had been, once the soil became less fertile, they had moved on and left it, and this second growth forest had grown up. And then an iron furnace was established just a few miles away, and they had cut over the land again. They had cut over that second growth forest in order to fuel the iron furnace. And so even 20 years before the Civil War broke out, the wilderness as we know it today, or as they knew it at the time of the war, was essentially a cut over landscape with almost no trees on it whatsoever. But then that iron furnace went out of business in 1847, and it closed. And so nobody tended to the the fields that had fueled the iron furnace anymore. And so the woods were allowed to grow up again, and they had grown for 17 years. And the what grows up are, you have a lot of tree stumps, particularly of hardwood, still there. And so you have these little suckers, as we call them, that start growing up from the tree stumps. And it creates this really dense melange of different types of trees that are growing up. But by the time the armies arrived in 1864, the forest had only been growing for 17 years, which means that practically no tree was taller than about 20 feet, and no tree was thicker than 3 or 4 inches in diameter. And so for those who go to the wilderness battlefield today, and the National Park Service does a wonderful job of preserving that and other Civil War battlefields, you may think that you're seeing what the soldiers saw at the time, but anybody who goes to the wilderness battlefield today sees 100-foot tall trees, some of which are 2 and 3 feet in diameter. And that's not what the soldiers saw at the time of the battle. They had a very low canopy of trees that were incredibly dense, but very thin. And so you couldn't see more than probably 20 or 30 yards, and people are firing at you. There is no tree to hide behind. I mean, it really was something to ratchet up the terror factor pretty extremely. Another example would be something we talk about at the very beginning of our final chapter, which is the campaign for Saltville, Virginia, which is in southwestern Virginia. And is an area that's, as its name implies, is sitting on very large deposits of salt, which were in many ways as valuable as gold to the Confederacy late in the war, because salt preserved meat, salt was needed for livestock, salt was needed to cure leather. So salt was incredibly important, and it was a vital asset to the Confederacy. And the Union launches a campaign in the fall of 1864 to destroy the salt works at Saltville. And the Union soldiers, when they get there, they find that they have to storm these high hills that are completely denuded of any sort of cover whatsoever. There are no trees or anything on the hills. And so they're basically sitting ducks trying to attack these Confederate positions. And the reason there aren't any trees on the hills, the reason they don't have any more cover, is because the Saltville, the salt furnaces required just a staggering amount of wood in order to fuel those furnaces. We actually have a stat in there to show that the amount of wood that was needed to fuel the salt furnaces to make the amount of salt that the Confederacy produced during the war would be producing a cord of wood 181 miles long. It's like it required that much timber, just to give yourself a sense of a visual of how much fuel was needed. So that meant basically all the trees in the surrounding area was just completely cut down. So by the time the Union gets there with the best intentions of destroying the salt works, they're turned back in their first foray in the fall of 1864 because the landscape proves forbidding, and there's no real defensive cover for them, and so they have to abandon the campaign. They do eventually take the salt works later when the Confederates have to remove troops and send them off to other threatened regions. But so those are a couple of examples of sort of interaction between people and nature sort of dictating some of the battles. And the last one I would like to point out is one of the things we always also wanted to talk about was not just how terrain affected battles, but how battles reshaped terrain or landscapes. And we decided to use the city of Atlanta as an example of that. And people are very familiar with Sherman's campaign to capture Atlanta. And what they're not familiar with, perhaps, is the after effects of that campaign, in which between Sherman's bombardment of the city of Atlanta, which he basically launched an artillery bombardment of Atlanta for about a month in the summer of 1864, between all the Confederate soldiers and all the Union soldiers cutting down just about every tree in the greater environs of Atlanta to use as fortifications or fuel or something of that nature, when the campaign ends and the armies move on, Atlanta not just is physically devastated, but the wells are damaged, and more importantly, there's no tree cover whatsoever in Atlanta. And trees absorb rainwater and prevent erosion. They absorb wastewater. So the trees provide a lot of important several lot of important uses. And what we find is that Sherman's campaign really reshapes the residential geography of Atlanta in the years after the war. I mean, the city grows by leaps and bounds after the Civil War, but the wealthier white citizens take to the high ground in the center of Atlanta, and the recently freed people who flock to Atlanta as well, they are shunted to the low-lying regions around the creeks and the rivers near Atlanta. Well, all the trees are gone, so there's no soaking up of much wastewater or sewage, and so all the sewage from the high ground where the whites are living goes down into the low-lying areas where the African-American population is living, and of course the hygiene problems that result from that and the illnesses that plague the freed people for decades after the Civil War. And then once the sort of high ground white area in the center of Atlanta is sort of saturated in population, the wealthier whites start looking for other places to live. And what dictates where they live is either high ground or good water, which even today is why many of the suburbs of Atlanta have those features denoting them. Druid Hills, where Emory University is, was one of the first suburbs where people move because it's high ground. Sandy Springs, Lithia Springs. I mean, these places have good water. And so really the greater geography of the city of Atlanta is shaped by that battle, by that military campaign in the summer of 1864. And it lasts with Atlanta for decades.
With the exception of what you just said about Atlanta and what Tim earlier said about embalming technologies and casket technologies, for the most part, each of these six chapters is concerned with trying and succeeding to prove that environmental factors matter a lot to the unfolding course of the war. But then at the end of the book, we get to this epilogue, and it's this powerhouse epilogue where you try to take on a much different and larger argument to make a claim that, in fact, the Civil War itself was a really important environmental event in the history of the nation. And you cover tons of ground in a very short space to show all the different ways that we really can't understand the environmental history of the United States in the late 19th century and beyond without understanding what happened in these 4 years. And so, Tim, I wonder if you could tell us a couple of ways that, you know, that what happened during the war transformed 19th century life going forward. And then even, you know, you both are living in North Carolina today. Are there ways you drive around and see the environmental legacies of the war around you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And that was one of my, when I was thinking about the Civil War and the environment, originally thinking about the book, if you're a Southern historian and you're interested in the history of the South, sooner or later you end up at the Civil War. I mean, it's just the way it works. And so I had sort of, put this off for most of my career because I didn't want to get into the Civil War, Confederate flags and mint juleps and, all that kind of stuff. But once I started thinking about the Civil War as a kind of environmental event and an event that's crucial to the environmental history of the South and the country, then I realized, it has to be confronted. And so, to answer your question about environmental legacies, we talked a little bit about some of the disease patterns that changed. And of course, that carried on well after the war in terms of these diseases continuing to kind of ravage areas where they had not been present before. We talked about the livestock and the ways in which that changed. And the South never really recovered from the livestock devastation. One of the things that was amazing to me is that the hog population of the South really did not recover from the Civil War, and numbers get to where they were get to pre-war levels really until the 1980s when we started to get these factory farms in the South. So that was, one long legacy. And then there are other things. The advent of veterinary medicine came right out of the war. Basically, there was no veterinary medicine practiced before the war, but animals were so crucial that in the aftermath, you've got the advent of veterinary medicine, and Iowa State became the first public university to have a veterinary medicine program. And, you know, probably the one thing that was sort of another eureka moment for us is we discovered how closely connected the National Weather Service is to the war, and that the sort of weather prediction that we have today, where we have weather stations around the country and we can monitor things, all of that is directly out of the Civil War. And then finally, probably the legacy that might be of most interest to environmental historians is right in the middle of some of the worst fighting, right in the middle of the Overland Campaign. In fact, right about the time of the Battle of the Wilderness is when Lincoln signs the legislation that puts the Yosemite Valley under the care of California, and of course later became Yosemite National Park. And it's shortly after the war, it's 1872, that Grant signs the legislation that creates Yellowstone National Park. And historians have kind of looked at this and argued that, you know, maybe what's happening here is that with the eastern landscape so completely devastated and torn apart by this awful cataclysm, that Americans begin to look to the west and these more, in their minds, pristine landscapes as worthy of preservation. And so that the Civil War may be tied intricately to the modern conservation movement. Now, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of work still to be done on that. But one historian, Aaron Sachs, who's done some work on this, sort of sees a parallel between trees mutilated by the war and men mutilated by the war, and the stumps of humans and the stumps of nature that that seems evident in the aftermath of the Civil War. And so the efforts to preserve the giant sequoias, all of which I believe are a number of them are named for Civil War generals, seems to play into that as well. So, you know, while there's still a lot of connections to be made, I think there's ample evidence that maybe the modern conservation movement, the national parks, some of these other things come right out of the Civil War. And that makes it a crucially important environmental event.
Well, the book is wonderful, and it's both because of the other work that it synthesizes and the claims it makes and the gaps it fills into the story. I think it'll be an important kind of mile marker in this rather late developing field of environmental histories of the Civil War. I'd love to hear what having done all this work for 8 years, how you both see the field going from here. You know, what would you like to see from future environmental studies of the war? And maybe you want to speak from your positions inside military history or environmental history. Maybe those don't really matter. Maybe the collaboration is really the key going forward. Judkin, you want to start us off?
Sure. I mean, first I can make a plug for collaboration, if nothing. But, you know, it's one of those things where it doesn't come naturally necessarily to historians. You think of multiple authored pieces being typical of the sciences and not so much in history. But I think Tim had a great idea with this collaboration bit, which is, you know, he was an environmental historian who was well-trained in those techniques, but, you know, didn't know the Civil War as much as someone who has studied the Civil War for 20 years would know it. And rather than think he could wing it, Tim decided, you know, let me bring in somebody who knows the war and let's merge our two respective specialties into this. And I think it worked a lot better, quite frankly, than probably either he or I thought it would going in. And so I would just make a plug to encourage other scholars out there to not be afraid to reach across the aisle and either, you know, ask somebody from the history discipline who does some genre that you aren't as familiar with but want to investigate further, or even reach across into other disciplines in the sciences. And because we certainly benefited from the assistance of geologists and health and exercise scientists and forestry people who all guided us in our work. And so I would just sort of make that play that I know being a historian tends to be a sort of solitary existence, but it doesn't have to be. And the reason I make that plug or make that suggestion is because as I say, I mean, I had been teaching the Civil War for a decade before I started writing this book with Tim, and I've changed every single one of my lectures on the Civil War based on what I've learned in researching this book. It just forced me to ask questions that I may never have thought of asking before until we started working on this book. And it really has opened my eyes to the Civil War in a way that I, trained as a military and a social historian, had never looked at it before.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. Just to tell a quick story, the reason I decided to have Judkin join me, or the moment I decided to have him join, or try to get him to join in on the book, was I was actually reading an article on chestnut blight in a botany journal, and I noticed that the author had called in a geneticist to help him out. And somehow that was sort of a slap in the face, like, you know, well, why don't I go get somebody who knows the Civil War, you know, and will help me out with this thing. And of course, when I brought Judkin on board, and he's talking about troop rosters and all these great sources, and I'm still trying to figure out how to pronounce Chickamauga, you know. but he knew that literature so well, and then I was able to kind of talk about, you know, the questions that we wanted to ask. So I think it worked out well. As to where it goes from here, there's so much stuff. I mean, the Civil War is the most written about event in American history for a reason. And there's just so many different ways to go. One of the things I think that really could stand more research is the thing I mentioned about the civilian population, how they were affected by these armies moving in. We only just scratched the surface on some of the environmental results of parking, you know, 50,000 people on a rural landscape and, in effect, having an instant city with all the problems of sewage and trash and disease and the kind of things that come with a city that lacks the infrastructure to deal with those sorts of problems. And I just think there's huge, you know, potential there for people to do more. And that's one place, just, you know, off the top of my head, that I think things could go in an interesting direction. Animals provide, you know, just another whole area in which you can do a lot more research. And I think that if you start to think about these kind of things, these military endeavors as environmental events, then it just opens up a whole range of possibilities. And so I think, you know, hopefully what people will do with this book is say, well, you know, that's interesting. Let me go see what I can find out about that. And you know, take it from there.
Exactly. I would definitely second that, you know, our book leaves of necessity lots of gaps, of course, because we look at each theme within a certain season of the war. And I just think I'm excited and would love to see, you know, other people take this, you know, young scholars, you know, say, well, I kind of like the idea that they're starting with here, but they didn't go deep enough. Let me go dig deeper and see what other stones I can overturn here. And you know, we unabashedly were doing a synthesis and using the work of some great scholars that have done some preliminary work. You mentioned Megan Kate Nelson earlier, and we certainly utilize her work, the work of medical historian Margaret Humphreys. Aaron Stewart Malden wrote a great book about the sort of environmental effects of agriculture in the South from 1840 to 1880. We borrowed
previous guest on the show.
Good. You know, the book is good too. And who's done some wonderful work on tobacco cultivation. So they're just, the list is endless. We could just name people all day long, but there's still so much more that can be done. And we just hope that, you know, our book, if anything, gets people excited about it and makes them want to go and ask their own questions about some of these topics and others that we never even had a chance to address.
In a lesson on environmental contingency that neither of you needed, your book was published a month into a global pandemic. And so I'm sure that has forestalled all the opportunities you've had to kind of get this out to people and visit universities and battlefields and bookstores to share this exciting work with folks. Hopefully that will all resume when we get past this things with knocking on wood over here. But at some point in the future, what do you have a sense of what projects you're going to turn your attention to next?
Well, you know, I'm not getting any younger, and and I've been around. You know, I started in environmental history when I had to go knock on the door of the botanist there at William and Mary, and nobody'd ever heard of environmental history. So I've been doing this a long time. And I must have told Judkin about 30 times, you know, in the course of writing the book, this is going to be my swan song. You know, I don't know. I keep getting these things that come to my mind. You know, probably some of the things that spring from this. And I'm particularly interested in this connection with the conservation movement and how we might, you know, try to flesh that out a little bit. So that may be something I'll work on. I don't know about another book, but, you know, maybe an essay or something down the road. On the COVID thing, yeah, that's been sort of a curse and a blessing in a way. We don't have to convince people anymore of the viability of disease as a research topic, you know. And people have told us, you know, well, I started reading your book, but it opens with a measles epidemic. not sure I want to read this. But it's also kind of kept us, as you say, sort of from getting out and you know, pressing the flesh a little bit and talking about the book. But I think it just underscores again. I mean, Americans have gotten a huge lesson here in how closely connected we are to the natural world. And I've always said that if there are any environmental historians left standing after this pandemic, the world has a big "I told you so" coming from all of us. So, you know, I think it's made people more aware, but it has, you know, it's restricted our getting out. In fact, these podcasts are great because they, you know, allow us to talk about the book and get out to a lot of people without actually having to go in person.
Yeah, to Tim's point, his wife read the book in draft form and was very encouraging, told Tim, "Oh, it reads really good." My wife started reading the first chapter and said she couldn't get through it. She felt ill. So, you know, that warning's out there. She read the book, but she had a hard time struggling through chapter one because of all the diseases. So
wait till she gets to the death.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, so in terms of future projects, I mean, I think the environment will always sort of now be a part of the questions that I ask of any future work that I do. I mean, I think researching this book has made me think of the war much more holistically in that sense. I mean, the next project I'm really working on is more of a reverberations of battle angle and sort of how one battle affects the men and the families and the communities they come from for decades or even generations after that battle. And I'm using a couple of regiments that annihilate each other the first day of Gettysburg to try to tell that story of the effects of a battle. And I hadn't previously thought of that really having much of an environmental footprint, but I think the questions I'm going to ask of that project now certainly are going to have some environmental ones, especially in terms of long-term health repercussions because of their experience and things of that nature. And so this book has really been enlightening for me. The research for this book, much less the writing of it, has opened me up to just a whole host of other sources that I wasn't previously familiar with.
The book again is An Environmental History of the Civil War. Its authors are, and my guests have been, Judkin Browning and Timothy Silver. It's out now from the University of North Carolina Press, so go grab your copy. Tim, Judkin, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.